Good morning. This is the Mideast Migraines program, the weekend edition on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, and we are streaming online at freakradio.org. Freakradio.org. Click on the listen link or on the red oval atop the pictured transmission tower. And my name is Ren Tawil.
Da pro es ku yamtlariya verken zogun verken ran vozni ein batay einer is go tum dop de zeine weiter keine mu asam pro mu da pro es ku yamtlariya verken zogun verken ran vozni zwei batay zwei ze vilich sunne mer is go tum dop de zeine Vier zijn die immes, en drie zijn die oves, en twee zijn die liefes, en een er is de God, en God de zijne, en weiter geene. Hey, moe, sapro, moe, dapro, wesko, wesko, jop de verria, werken, zogen, werken, rennen, was die vier partij, vier zijn die hamushim, en vier zijn die immes, en drie zijn die oves, en twee zijn die liefes, en een er is de God, en God de zijne. Taschenbaden, hoch meine
ohme Taschen auf meine Weiße, hoch mit meine ohme Taschen auf passierter Meise. Hoch meine ohme Taschen auf meine Weiße, hoch mit meine ohme Taschen auf passierter Meise. Geht der Regen, geht der Schnee, kappet und die Dächer. Ja, ne, wir schön in Kornel. Da sagt mit Lechem, hopp meine ohme Taschen, hopp meine Weiße, hopp mit meine ohme Taschen, hopp passiert der Meise. Hopp meine ohme Taschen, hopp meine Weiße, hopp mit meine ohme Taschen, hopp passiert der Meise. Ja, net rockt schon Schalachmones zu der Mumme jente. Zwei, drei schwarze ohme Taschen, halb roi, halb verbrennt. Hopp meine ohme Taschen, hopp meine Weiße, hopp mit meine ohme Taschen, hopp passiert der Meise. Hopp meine ohme Taschen, hopp meine Weiße, hopp mit meine ohme Taschen, hopp passiert der Meise.
Yes, indeedy. Again, this is Theodore Bickel singing a collection of Jewish folk songs. On a recent program, I read an article from Hollywood's Variety magazine that was printed upon the death of this artist, a many-faceted artist. Again, the name is Theodore Bickel, or Bickel, born in Austria, and father moved his family to Palestine when he was a boy. Now, I'm not going to give you the whole bio again. I don't even have it in front of me. But first, let me say the names of the songs that you were listening to, starting with the latest. And these are, again, traditional Jewish folk songs. Homintaschen was the last item. Before that, you were listening to Lomir sich Aberbeten. And we began the show, the musical three in a row hits, with Mus Aspare. There'll be more later from this wonderful artist. Now, Saturday editions of the Mideast Migraines program, the alternate time slot being every Monday at 3 p.m. in the afternoon Pacific time, 3 o'clock to 4:55. Essentially, both shows are two hours long and produced independently of one another. But I, Ren Tawil, am the host for both of them. Getting back to the original intention of this Saturday version of the show, past listeners will know that I reserved the Saturday show normally for the readings of books. Several books I've written on the air over the course of a few months, cover to cover, books all on the topic of either Palestine and Israel and how they and their people relate to one another, or perhaps don't relate to one another. I also read a synopsis, actually an anthology of eight articles that was put together by Jewish Voice for Peace, the organization, on the topic of reframing anti-Semitism, alternative Jewish perspectives. That was one of the half dozen or so books that I read. All of these books are, again, chapter by chapter, recorded and archived at another website, radioforall.net. That's a radio, the number for ALL.NET, radioforall.net, and just do a search first on Mideast Migraines so that you may see all of my programs, roughly in chronological order, the most recent first, and you can dig in and find the past readings of those shows, which pretty much you can treat as any audiobook or ebook. Listen to them at your own convenience, when you want and how you want. Good news, Free Radio Santa Cruz has just signed a contract for a new studio, which is to say another location, a new location. In fact, it is, going way back, an old location where our studio was once located for a period of time. That was way before my time. Free Radio Santa Cruz is a 21-year-old operation, one of perhaps two remaining free radio services left in the state of California. Pirate radio, unlicensed with the FCC, community grassroots programming, on-air programming. Now, so we have signed an agreement. We'll be moving in into this new place soon, this new location, which is in the city of Santa Cruz. And the rest is foregone history. We'll find out more later as we move in and plug everything in and rebuild our furniture and all that logistical nonsense. And what I'm looking forward to is having a higher quality of sound reproduction. As it is, I'm still producing shows. I am at this very moment, Friday night before the scheduled broadcast at 11 a.m. Saturday, yelling onto my keyboard because there's an embedded microphone in there somewhere, I'm told. And my personal PC. So I'm creating these programs now at home in my bedroom, really, bedroom/den/ hangout for many species of spiders. I like spiders. And as I was saying, I'm looking forward to higher performance of quality in the resonance and the tone and the general sound before I go back to book readings. And until that happens, I'm going to continue to read some very basic primers, or what amounts to literature amounting to a primer on the topic of Palestine and Israel, of Jews and Arabs and Christians and Muslims and all that good stuff. But before I get into the meat of that, before I return to this one entitled The Origin of the Palestine-Israel Conflict, one of probably hundreds in English alone with that title or a similar title, The Origin of the Palestine-Israel Conflict. We're already several pages into it. But first, let me talk some more about Theodore Bickel, the man who sang and played guitar for you on the show a few minutes ago. I read his bio according to the article in Variety. Bickel passed away last July 2015. And at one point, it was noted that Bickel lamented the fact that he was torn between leaving Israel when he did in order to perform his theatrical artistry, I believe in the United States, perhaps Hollywood, SoCal, whatever, wherever, between doing that and remaining to fight in Israel's war to establish itself as a nation. He did indeed face harsh criticism. Apparently, some even called into question his ability to be brave, act courageously, and to fight for Israel. As it turned out, the man did not. Some called him coward. I'm not going to go there personally because I don't know what all of his thoughts were. But as I said, he was quoted in the article as saying something non-verbatim. He said he had to do a lot of deep thinking about whether or not his decision to leave Israel at about that time in 1948 was wise or not. Well, I just as I began doing the show, I began thinking of something that I thought I had once, some time ago, read of the very words of Theodore Bickel about the Palestinians or Arab children, and this is what I came up with. This is the item. Let's see, I typed into the search box Bickel, B-I-K-E-L, Palestinian Rights. And this is the item with the most hits. It is from the Jewish Journal, Connect, Inform, Inspire. It's opinion section. And this is dated September 5 of 2014. About a year and a half ago. September of 2 years ago. Lovely picture of the man smiling widely. This would be just less than less than 12 months before his passing, before his death. Here is the opinion piece by Theodore Bikel. This may possibly affect you in terms of why I've chosen to play Jewish music on the show, in addition to all the other various Arab and Middle Eastern musical numbers and CDs that I've played. So, from Jewish Journal, September 5, 2014, opinion. Grieving the Children of Palestine and the Dream of Zionism, by Theodore Bikel. Through all the turmoil of these last weeks and months, I have been tortured by thoughts of children. Jewish children, Palestinian children, Syrian, Iraqi children, all those who most innocently of all, and most grievously of all, are the victims of the Middle East madness. Rachel Mebaka et Baneha. Rachel mourns her children. With her I weep for the children, knowing that they are all her children, our children, every one of them. The shameful apologists trying to justify the death of Arab children with trite explanations of collateral damage and use children as shields and they will die fill me with anger. Yes, a Jewish child's life, if precious to me, but how dare anyone suggest that another child's life is less precious, less deserving of a future? What is most frustrating is that those who place lesser values on non-Jews are supposed stalwarts of a community that I can no longer rightfully call mine. I'm going to read that sentence again. Remember, these are the words of Theodore Bikel, actor, song spinner, and man of actually of many talents, an artist in the fuller sense of the word. He says, and I quote, What is most frustrating is that those who place lesser values on non-Jews, and he's not even necessarily talking about children only here, are supposed stalwarts of a community that I can no longer rightfully call mine. Where is the commitment to open dialogue, the respect to hear out opposing ideas? Where is the dictum that commands us to listen, to debate, to agonize with each other rather than hurl epithets of disloyalty? People see suffering, and unless it is Jewish suffering, they are silent. How dare they? Many years ago, at the famous March on Washington, Rabbi Joachim Prinz declared that the crime of the century was silence, silence in the face of injustice. I say it now to my own community. Jewish silence in the face of injustice is intolerable because Jews are commanded to live by a moral code that calls such silence not only wrong, but makes it a crime. My father has been gone for many years now, but he left me to be the guardian of his dream, a dream of Zionism whose engine to fulfillment would be the socialism of the kibbutz movement. Both have now been corrupted and made irreverent in a land that practices capitalist consumerism and allows children to go to bed hungry. In my mind, I have been offering my father apologies that his dream has been thwarted and that both he and I are left with the sadness of frustrated hope. I am an old man now, but I know how to grieve over a boyhood dream that has gone. Short and bittersweet. Opinion piece. Authored by Theodore Bikel from a Jewish Journal, September 2014. Here is the biographical paragraph. Theodore Bikel, 90 years old, as of 2 years ago, is the chairman of Partners for a Progressive Israel. He has served as national vice president of the American Jewish Congress and as president of Actors Equity and the 4A's. Letter A's. His latest film, Theodore Bikel in the Shoes of Shalom Aleichem, recently premiered at the San Francisco Jewish Film Festival. His updated autobiography, Theo, T-H-E-O, has been published early this summer, and his recording on Elektra Records are now available for download on iTunes. Again, Bikel's recording on Elektra Records are now available for download on iTunes. I presume that is still the case. And, okay, I was right. He did express a sentiment, Bikel did, in the direction that I thought I had remembered. Even if he had not written this opinion piece, even if he had never specifically expressed any other such thoughtful pieces in print or online or wherever, recorded, even if he hadn't, I would still be playing his music, I assure you, because like I said, it's not like I was thinking, oh, didn't he say something on behalf of Palestinian children? Well, I guess it's okay to play his music. No. I couldn't resist buying the album when I saw it, while I was selecting a lot of other Arabic, Iranian, and other Middle Eastern music, Azerbaijani, etc. I wanted to have it, and I felt that it had a place here on this program. His music, in terms of interstitial entertainment, getting away from the boring monotony of the readings, etc. But I'm sure glad that I had remembered that he had said such things. In fact, as I indicated earlier, now that piece was from JewishJournal.com. There's another article, Why Some Jewish Stars Support Israeli Artistic Boycott, which is to say the boycott against Israeli cultural and academic venues. That was from the foreword.com, and also has here's the first sentence from the explanation of this item from the list here. At the age of 86, so this is going back a good 5 years or so before the one I just read, Bikel, who fled his native Vienna for Palestine, as a ... they remember the McCarthy times and the civil rights struggle. She said, okay, I should know better than to read bits and pieces of things that are rarely more than bits and pieces. There's truly a lot of stuff, generally in memoriam for the man, but a few surviving snippets that indicate that he, too, was able to see through the bright, shiny fluff of Zionism as it was expressed about 125 years ago, and came to the hard-nosed facts about what it really involved, about whether or not Palestine was truly a land without people for the Jewish people who have been without a land. Okay, I wanted to get that out of the way. We salute Theodore Bikel. Now I want to get one more thing out of the way, and then a couple of logistical items before the primer reading for this Saturday, May the 14th, 2016. Show comes to you every Saturday at 1100 hours, 11 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time. I had the pleasure of attending the Santa Clara County, California Palestinian Cultural Day, the 15th annual one, in fact. This was forwarded to me by one Lorene Zazunis. Greetings, my good friends. This event is very unique, and my friend Samir works tirelessly and diligently each year to create this fantastic cultural event with local politicians and many other community leaders at the Santa Clara County Building, specifically the Isaac Newton Center Auditorium. The raising of the Palestinian flag in the courtyard is truly a moving and special activity that opens the program, and I hope you can join this year. I did indeed switch counties on this day, drove over the hill, and went to the Palestinian Cultural Fair. Not the first one I attended, although it was the first one of this at this venue, the 15th annual Santa Clara County Palestinian Cultural Day. I've been to one in San Francisco before. That was several years ago. Samir, in fact, the aforementioned good friend Samir that Loreen referred to was the master of ceremonies. And let me just read to you a little more from the promo piece. I was, upon approaching the crowd, I must be fully honest and say that I was disappointed. I just assumed that there would be a lot more people there, not to say that there were way too few, simply fewer than I expected. And that's probably because I remembered the one in San Francisco that I went to roughly 10 years ago. They probably still hold that there on Brotherhood Boulevard in San Francisco. Sorry, folks. I believe I clicked on the wrong. Let me go to their Facebook page instead. Santa Clara County 15th Annual Palestinian Cultural Day. According to this webpage counter here, 193 showed interest and 109 went. It was, as per its own schedule, an hour and a quarter long, 3:45 to 5 p.m. this afternoon, this Friday before the broadcast afternoon, again held at the County Government Center at 70 West Heading Street in San Jose. I love to remind people that San Jose is indeed a real city. It's the county seat of Santa Clara County. But when most people think about Santa Clara County, if they know anything about it, when they think of this neck of the woods, it seems to me they first think Silicon Valley, quote unquote, before they think of San Jose. San Jose is roughly on a population par with San Francisco. In fact, I remember a few decades ago, I thought I remembered somewhere that at the last count, more people actually live in San Jose than live in San Francisco, the latter being the city of my birth, the former being the general neighborhood where I grew up. It's not Silicon Valley, folks. It's think of San Jose as the capital of Silicon Valley, if you really must think anything along those lines. Getting back to business here, it was certainly a relief when I came back home and told the missus here what had transpired. Frankly, it was only an hour and a quarter long presentation, not exactly a performance. But I explained to her, that, as it was explained to us, that the purpose of the event is to celebrate Palestinian presence in Santa Clara County. All of the communities there, San Jose, Santa Clara, Milpitas, Los Gatos, the Palestinians who for a very long time now have been scattered in their own diaspora, a word which until recent times has been reserved for the scattering of the Jewish people when they chose to leave the Holy Land a couple of millennia ago. So the political figures, celebrities who were there, applauded the fact that there is such a celebration, and there were presentations of plaques and statements from the County Board of Supervisors, and a very inspiring and highly positive speech, not too long, from one of the Board of Supervisors members. He might have even been the chairman, I can't remember. The City of San Jose has its first ever Palestinian American council member. His name is Johnny Camus. They pronounce it Camus, but obviously we're talking the Arabic language, Khamis, K-H-A-M-I-S. Johnny Camus. I had heard of him when he was, before he became a council member, when he began his campaign, and his one classic thing happened against him that I was aware of. I'm sure there were a number of measures of protest, if you will, at the fact that a Palestinian American, an Arab American, God help us, was running to be a council member of what may be, by some measure, the richest city in all of the world, San Jose, or the richest county anyway, or perhaps both. When he had an opportunity to speak with me, I sidled up to him and I told him about this one guy in particular who was upset that at one point in his campaign, Johnny Camas said, quote unquote, that he wanted to do something for the Palestinian people. This set someone who had heard that bit of news off and irate. He was appalled that anyone who runs for city council in an American city or is an American, an Arab American who happens to grab a mic in this country, could have even said something like, "I want to help the Palestinians." And this particular dude, I can't remember his name now, this statement was leaked somehow, came across to me on my email. He started contacting his friends and colleagues all around and saying, "We have got to stop this man. We cannot let him be the council member of the city of San Jose," apparently because of a statement in support of Palestine. For my part, I popped off a page and a half to this person who was so irate and in such a mood of protestation, basically just pointing out how silly his whole point of view was, not to mention essentially biased and perhaps even racist. I can't remember if I used the word racist or racism, but I know that I got my point across, and I know that he read it because he replied with a very, very short couple of sentences saying, "Thank you, I read and I understood your message," something to that effect. Of course, that was not to my satisfaction. He never expounded any more than that. He just said, "Thank you, I read your note." I thought he could have said something more about where he was coming from and wanting to prevent this particular Arab American from taking his seat on the city council. So I did that. I spoke with him after the at the breakup of the proceedings. There was which began, by the way, with a very short video, 1 minute video of many little children, presumably Palestinian Americans, playing violin in unison, and it was very admirable. At one point, I was forced to leave for my own purposes. Leave in the middle of the celebration to do something, and when I came back, I had just missed chamber orchestra piece again by some young people. I saw them. I came in during the applause, and someone walked away with their cello and their viola and violins. So not a whole lot to that. Other than the generous positive rancor. And then we went out and ate, of course, flatbread, tabbouleh, falafel, saffron rice on paper plates in the courtyard. And I handed out a bunch of business cards, which indicate that I do indeed have this Mideast Migraines program on Free Radio Santa Cruz. So that was a duty that I saw to. So I'm happy that I made the drive over into Santa Clara County to attend that. Okay, I think we're essentially ready. Let me remind everyone that, as I said, you can go to the website radioforall.net for the number four, the digital character for radio4all.net for the archives of my past programs, including book readings, and a number of audio and, for my end of it anyway, also video interviews and documentary revelations about what's going on in the Holy Land. Now, let me also remind you that since I am at home and I cannot answer a studio phone, our studio phone is temporarily in mothballs right now because our new studio is not yet set up. We cannot have a conversation on the phone during my show, which I would be more than happy to do back when we had a studio, and I expect to do when we're set up and running in our new studio. Instead, if you want to respond to any of this, if you want to just check in and say, hi, thank you, I got your business card today, and great show, or I hated your show, whatever, you can write to this program's email address, MideastMadness@gmx.com. The phrase Middle East Madness did appear in Theodore Bickel's opinion piece in the Jewish Journal that I read to you. Total coincidence. In fact, I once referred to this show, what used to be called Mideast Madness, until I decided that that particular phraseology is probably overused in the media, electronic and otherwise. And indeed, I know there are some other ones out there. So I changed it to Mideast Migraines. But the website is still Mideast Madness, all one word, at gmx.com. That's G as in George, M as in Marcus, X as in xylophone. Yes, X.com. MideastMadness@gmx.com. Please do communicate with me. I'd love to hear from you, whether you've been listening to me consistently, or this is the first time you happened upon the show or made it a point to tune in. All right. Let us begin the primer. The time, by the way, even though this is not a live show, according to my recording program, I've got approximately what would translate to 11:39 a.m. on Saturday, May the 14th. It's about 11:39 in the morning. Now, come to think of it, in reality, because I paused the recording here a couple of times, it's probably closer to a good quarter of an hour before 12 noon. Okay, back to the book that I began, the booklet that I began reading. Introductions again. This is published by Jews for Justice in the Middle East and distributed by If Americans Knew. I highly suggest everyone out there go to ifamericansknew.org, IAK.org. It's called The Origin of the Palestine-Israel Conflict, third edition, and parenthetically including Intifada 2000. Which would refer to the Second Intifada. Yes, indeed, published by Jews for Justice in the Middle East and distributed by ifamericansknew.org and the Council for the National Interest.org. Admittedly, both those organizations, If Americans Knew and Council for the National Interest, are essentially, for these publishing purposes, virtually the same organization, from what I understand. Okay, I believe I left off at this section. Forgive me if I am doing any unnecessary rereading, but I will endeavor to complete this booklet by the end of this program. The Origin of the Palestine-Israel Conflict, we have page-long introduction, and then the various oversections, early history of the region, a little anthropological history there, the British Mandate period, 1920 to 1948, the UN partition of Palestine. Now let's begin on statehood and expulsion, 1948. The word statehood here refers to the birth of the modern 20th century state of Israel. Statehood and expulsion, 1948. Was the part of Palestine assigned to a Jewish state in mortal danger from the Arab armies? And these subsections here all generally have that format. Question, and then a paragraphical answer. Was the part of Palestine assigned to a Jewish state by the United Nations partition ever in mortal danger from the Arab armies? Answer? The answers are all in quotes here. I will give the source of the quote at the end of it. Quote, the Arab League hastily called for its member countries to send regular army troops into Palestine. They were ordered to secure only the sections of Palestine given to the Arabs under the UN partition plan. Let me say that again. Arab armies called by the Arab League to go to Palestine were ordered to secure only the sections of Palestine given to the Arabs under the partition plan, the Arab state area. But these regular armies were ill-equipped and lacked any central command to coordinate their efforts. Jordan's King Abdullah promised the Israelis and the British that his troops, the Arab Legion, the only real fighting force among the Arab armies, would avoid fighting with Jewish settlements. Yet Western historians record this as the moment when the young state of Israel fought off, in sub-quotations here, the overwhelming hordes of five Arab countries. In reality, the Israeli offensive against the Palestinians intensified, end quote. This is from the book Our Roots Are Still Alive, published by the People's Press Palestine Book Project. Next subsection. Ethnic cleansing of the Arab population of Palestine. Quote, Joseph Weitz was the director of the Jewish National Land Fund. On December 19, 1940, he wrote, it must be clear that there is no room for both peoples in this country. The Zionist enterprise, so far, has been fine and good in its own time and could do with land buying. But this will not bring about the state of Israel. That must come all at once in the manner of a salvation. And then in parentheses, this is the secret of the messianic idea. And there is no way besides transferring the Arabs from here to the neighboring countries to transfer them all. Except maybe for Bethlehem, Nazareth, and Old Jerusalem, we must not leave a single village, not a single tribe. There were literally hundreds of such statements made by Zionists, end quote. Edward Said, from his book, The Question of Palestine. Edward Said was a Palestinian Arab born over there and ended up essentially a displaced person with his family when they came to the United States, most likely never to return to the home, to the old country. Okay. Again, under the general subsection of ethnic cleansing of the Arab population of Palestine, ethnic cleansing continued. And again, starting in quotes, all these exponentiations begin with a quote, some quotation. Following the outbreak of 1936, no mainstream Zionist leader was able to conceive of future coexistence and peace without a clear physical separation between the two peoples. Achievable only by way of transfer and expulsion. Let me explain here. Let me clarify. It started by saying following the outbreak of 1936. This obviously is in reference to the beginning of the Arab Revolt in Palestine. The Arab Revolt, the Palestinian Arab Revolt, which was an attempt for the Arabs who lived in Palestine to acquire and achieve sovereignty for their own Arab state. That battle lasted from 36 to 39, 1939, and was crushed by the British occupation forces in the end. By the way, most of the leaders of that revolt were either killed or imprisoned or forced to flee, which says pretty much the whole truth about what happened to the Palestinian leadership by 1947 and 1948. It says much about why there was so much disagreement among Palestinian Arabs when their original inspirational political leaders were gone. either just plain out of the country or no longer alive. Okay, let's continue with this. Achievable only by way of transfer and expulsion. Publicly, they all continued to speak of coexistence and to attribute the violence to a small minority of zealots and agitators. Publicly, they continued to say that. But this was merely a public pose. Ben-Gurion summed up, with compulsory transfer, we would have a vast area, inferring for settlement of Jews. I support compulsory transfer. I don't see anything immoral in it. End of that quotation. This according to Israeli historian Benny Morris from Righteous Victims. Now that is either the name of Morris's book or an article or an essay. Benny Morris, Righteous Victims. And one thing further on ethnic cleansing. Speaking of Israeli statehood and expulsion of Arabs. It's a quotation from, again, from Benny Morris, from The Birth of the Palestinian Refugee Problem, 1947 to 1949. Ben-Gurion clearly wanted as few Arabs as possible to remain in the Jewish state. He hoped to see them flee. He said as much to his colleagues and aides in meetings in August, September, and October in 1948, but no general expulsion policy was ever enunciated, and Ben-Gurion always refrained from issuing clear or written expulsion orders. He preferred that his generals, quote, understand what he wanted done. He wished to avoid going down in history as the, quote, great expeller, and he did not want the Israeli government to be implicated in a morally questionable policy. But while there was no expulsion policy, the July and October 1948 offensives by Israel were characterized by far more expulsions and indeed brutality towards Arab civilians than the first half of the war, end quote. Again, Benny Morris, The Birth of the Palestinian Refugee Problem, 1947 to 49. Those years straddle the year of Israel's creation in May of 48. I cannot help but tell you what I'm thinking about right now. I would generally prefer to stick with the exact wording of the printed word here. I'm not reading this on the computer, by the way. I'm holding it in my hand. It's a paper pamphlet on white paper pages here. This situation with Ben-Gurion deliberately avoiding putting any orders down on paper, spelling out an expulsion policy, it smacks right in the face of what Hitler, what the situation with Hitler and the Nazis was reputed to be in terms of what they deemed to be the quote-unquote final solution to the quote-unquote Jewish problem in Germany and in Europe, rather than actually write down for someone to pick up and leak and use later in rendering a future biography of Hitler or a history of the Nazis. Hitler and his henchmen, his generals, avoided putting it in print. They may have spoken of a final solution, but rarely, if ever, talked about the deliberate actual physical genocide by gassing and starvation and exposure, etc., of the 6 million Jews and the roughly, I don't know how many millions, maybe only a million or so other undesirables in Nazi society, Catholics, gays, queers, crippled people, perhaps deformed people. In addition to the 6 million Jews, they too met their deaths similarly, and it was all part of the final solution to get rid of society's supposedly unwanted and undesirables. Hitler had his final solution, even though it might not have been delineated in writing. Ben-Gurion, the renowned founder of the modern Zionist State of Israel, had his expulsion policy, though not enumerated or put down on paper. Okay, let's continue to the next item. Didn't the Palestinians leave their homes voluntarily during the 1948 war? Aha, some people are perking up their ears. They think they've heard something about this, or they've heard something about it in the past. Didn't the Palestinians leave their homes voluntarily during the 1948 war? Quote, Israeli propaganda has largely relinquished the claim that the Palestinian exodus of 1948 was, quote, self-inspired. Largely relinquished the claim. Official circles implicitly concede that the Arab population fled as a result of Israeli action, whether directly, as in the case of the cities of Lydda and Ramle, or Lydda and Ramle, or indirectly due to the panic that and similar similar actions, as in the Deir Yassin massacre, inspired in Arab population centers throughout Palestine. It's not written very well. I wouldn't use the word inspired, motivated, or threatened, maybe. Continuing. However, even though the historical record has been grudgingly set straight, the Israeli establishment still refuses to accept moral or political responsibility for the refugee problem it or its predecessors actively created. End quote. From Peretz Kidron, quoted in Blaming the Victims. Editors, Edward Said and Hitchens. Said and Hitchens. Okay. You're listening to the Mideast Migraines program on Free Radio Santa Cruz, streaming online at freakradio.org, as in freakradio.organization. Click on the listen link or the red oval. And we are broadcasting on traditional radio sets to the city of Santa Cruz, California, on the central left coast here, at 101.3 on the FM dial, 101.3 FM. And as far as I know, 101.3 is exactly where we're going to return to when we're back on air from our station studio. And it is very roughly 12 noon this Saturday, May 14th. Mideast Migraines program. My name is Lawrence Ren Tawil, your friendly local neighborhood Palestinian American. Who would have guessed, huh? Arab orders to evacuate non-existent. Quote, the BBC, British Broadcasting Corporation, monitored all Middle Eastern broadcasts throughout 1948. Pay close attention now. The records and companion ones by a United States monitoring unit can be seen at the British Museum. There was not a single order or appeal or suggestion about evacuation from Palestine from any Arab radio station, inside or outside Palestine, in 1948. Note, it specified from any Arab, as an Arab-speaking or Arab nation-located radio station, inside or outside of Palestine, 1948. Continuing, there is a repeated monitored record of Arab appeals, even flat orders, to the civilians of Palestine to stay put. End quote. This fascinating piece of information about BBC and United States monitoring of radio broadcast from Erskine Childers, British researcher, quoted in Sami Hadawi, Bitter Harvest. Bitter Harvest. Erskine Childers, in my opinion, is one of the most important resources in untangling and setting straight the myths and misconceptions of the creation of the modern state of Israel and what happened to Palestinian Arabs. Erskine Childers is the main personality behind this piece of research that indicated there were no such radio broadcasts of Arabs telling the Palestinian Arabs to flee. In fact, if anything, they said the opposite. Stay where you are, stay in your home, stay put. Do not risk leaving at the dawn of an impending battle. Okay, continuing now. More on ethnic cleansing. Specifically, this last item, orders, Arab orders to evacuate non-existent. quote, that Ben-Gurion's ultimate aim was to evacuate as much of the Arab population as possible from the Jewish state can hardly be doubted, if only from the variety of means he employed to achieve this purpose. Most decisively, the destruction of whole villages and the eviction of their inhabitants, even if they had not participated in the war and had stayed in Israel hoping to live in peace and equality as promised in the Declaration of Independence. That refers to Israel's Declaration of Independence. Israeli author Sima Flapan, from The Birth of Israel. The deliberate destruction of Arab villages to prevent return of Palestinians. New topic here. Quote, during May 1948, ideas about how to consolidate and give permanence to the Palestinian exile began to crystallize, and the destruction of villages was immediately perceived as a primary means of achieving this aim. And even earlier, on 10 April, Haganah units took Abu Shusha. The village was destroyed that night. Hulda was leveled by British bulldozers on 20 April, 10 days later. Abu Zurek was completely demolished. Al-Manzi and Anagnagiha to the southeast were also leveled. By mid-1949, the majority of the 350 depopulated Arab villages were either completely or partly in ruins and uninhabitable. End quote. Benny Morris, The Birth of the Palestinian Refugee Problem, 47 to 49, between those years. After the fighting was over, why didn't the Palestinians return to their homes? Quote, the first UN General Assembly resolution, number 194, affirming the right of Palestinians to return to their homes and property, was passed on December 11, 1948. It has been repassed no less than 28 times since that first date, December 11, 1948. Whereas the moral and political right of a person to return to his place of uninterrupted residence is acknowledged everywhere, Israel has negated the possibility of return and systematically and juridically made it impossible on any grounds whatever for the Arab population to return, be compensated for his property, or live in Israel as a citizen equal before the law with a Jewish Israeli, end quote. This from Edward Said, Palestinian-American, born in Palestine, from his book, The Question of Palestine. Still reading from The Origin of the Palestine-Israel Conflict, 3rd edition, published by Jews for Justice in the Middle East, distributed by If Americans Knew. The deliberate destruction of Arab villages to prevent return of Palestinians. I know this might sound awfully repetitive and redundant, but that's the way it's laid out in this primer. During May 19th, that's because I just read it to you. Okay, new subsection here. After the fighting was over, why didn't the Palestinians return to their homes? I read that to you too. Okay, I promise this is new stuff here. Is there any justification for this expropriation of land? Is there any justification for this expropriation of land, the taking and acquiring of land? Quote, the fact that the Arabs fled in terror because of real fear of a repetition of the 1948 Zionist massacres is no reason for denying them their homes, fields, and livelihoods. Civilians caught in an area of military activity generally panic. Civilians do. But they have always been able to return to their homes when the danger subsides, according to this here. Military conquest does not abolish private rights to property, nor does it entitle the victor to confiscate their homes, property, and personal belongings of the non-combatant civilian population. The seizure of Arab property by the Israelis was an outrage. This from Sami Hadawi, Bitter Harvest. How about the negotiations after the 1948-49 war? Quote, at Lausanne, which I believe is in France, Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, and the Palestinians were trying to save by negotiations what they had lost in the war, a Palestinian state alongside Israel. Israel, however, preferred tenuous armistice agreements to a definite peace that would involve territorial concessions and the repatriation of even a token number of refugees. The Israelis did. The refusal to recognize the Palestinians' right to self-determination and statehood proved over the years to be the main source of the turbulence, violence, and bloodshed that came to pass. From Israeli author Simcha Flippan, The Birth of Israel. Israel admitted to the United Nations. Let me start that again, make sure we understand what is meant by the word admitted. Israel, the country, was admitted to the UN, but then reneged on the conditions under which it was admitted. How many of you knew that? Quote, the conference in Lausanne officially opened on 27 April 1949. On 12 May 49, the UN's Palestine Conciliation Committee reaped its only success when it induced the parties to sign a joint protocol on the framework for a comprehensive peace. Israel, for the first time, accepted the principle of repatriation of the Arab refugees and the internationalization of Jerusalem. But they did so as a mere exercise in public relations aimed at strengthening Israel's international image. Walter Eitan, E-Y-T-A-N, the head of the Israeli delegation, stated, and here's quoting Walter Eitan here, "My main purpose was to begin to undermine the protocol of 12 May, which we had signed only under duress of our struggle for admission to the UN. I'll read it again. My main purpose was to begin to undermine the protocol of 12 May, which we had signed only under duress of our struggle for admission to the UN. Refusal to sign would have immediately been reported to the Secretary General and the various governments," end quote. This by Israeli historian Alon Pape, The Making of the Arab-Israel Conflict, 1947 to 1951. Pape discussed that range of years, all the way up to 51. And it was, a couple of weeks ago that I had the distinct pleasure of meeting Mr. Pape, who is in his 90s now, I believe, either very late 80s or 90s, at the Justice for Palestine conference in Santa Cruz, California, a couple of days on the weekend. Pape was there to give two or three major presentations, lectures, and I think he might have led one or two workshops in the course of that conference. Let me speak briefly about that conference again, as I spoke quite a bit about it before the actual event of 29 April and 30 April. I was deeply involved in the planning and execution of the, well, at least the planning of the conference. I tried to help. And sure enough, the more savvy members of our various committees anticipated there would be trouble. Possible protesters at the site of the conference, which was up on the west side of Santa Cruz, Peace United Church in Christ up on High Street, if not actual protesters parading and picketing, They would have plenty to say in the big newspaper of the city, the Santa Cruz Sentinel, in the form of letters to the editor and perhaps opinion editorials, op-eds. I have read some of those. I think I've read the most important ones. I don't get the paper, and it's even difficult for me with the other various things that I have to read and busy myself with to get to SC Sentinel stuff. But sure enough, there were people who were angry that there would even be such a Justice for Palestine conference apparently anywhere in the United States, let alone in Santa Cruz County, California. Because many Zionists and supporters of Israel, and not only Jews, mind you, but in particular Christian Zionists, become frighteningly irate, if not, alarmingly irate, to the point of being silly, in their protest over anyone who uses the word Palestine or Palestinian, particularly in the title of the conference, Justice for Palestine. They blow their tops when anyone talks about any national entity or notion of a country in what they consider to be the land of Israel as handed down to them by God according to their religious beliefs. And sure enough, those letters came in, but it should be noted that there were also letters of support. And online, on the Santa Cruz Sentinel online edition, argumentation among people as to whether or not the conference was a good thing, as to whether or not the conference had as its hidden purpose the supposed destruction of the Israeli state and the killing off of all the Jewish people in Palestine. It did not. But you hear this all the time from people who want to make waves whenever a group of people get together under First Amendment rights in America, in the United States, to talk about things that need to be talked about. Okay, enough of that, my ranting there. So, let me see, where was I? It was, I only spoke to Ilan Pape, the author of The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, and dozens of other books. I couldn't believe the number of books I had, but his name is the author attached to it, that were being sold there, lots and lots of stuff. And I also purchased a book that I'll be reading to you as soon as we get the studio set up. I'll let you know later what the title is and who wrote it, but I will let you know that the author of the book I'm going to read to you was one of the speakers at the conference, which included many Jews, including Pape and the guy who wrote the book that I just talked about that I'm going to read to you. And I also want to point out that conference organizers made it a point to offer scholarship admissions, or whatever else they might have referred to them as, scholarship admissions to Jewish people who otherwise might have been vigorously and loudly protesting at the fact that it was being held, perhaps even supposedly without their being allowed to participate or to attend. Indeed, sort of comp tickets, scholarship admissions paid, all paid for. And I was in meeting today with some of my people, my colleagues, and I believe the number was 22 of them. 22 Jews were, well, generally anyone was allowed to participate, but 22 Jewish people in particular were given these scholarship admits to the conference, many of them from a particular synagogue in town here, one of the major Jewish temples. Frankly, out of concern, as I indicated, that they would otherwise be making trouble and saying mostly bad things about us in the conference if they were not allowed to attend. We certainly wanted to share this wealth of information and witnessing and ideas with them and with everyone. I can tell you in at least one instance, according to a story I heard in meeting today with my homies, with my colleagues, that one of these people who got a comp ticket, as it were, complimentary admission, was vigorously taking notes during the entire time that she was attending workshops and speeches, this witnessed by one of the people in my group, one of my colleagues, vigorously taking notes. And when this friend of mine approached her and said, Have you learned anything new? The person taking notes, although she said she was generally polite and not acrimonious at all, said to her immediately, "No, not a bit. I haven't learned anything." And sure enough, this person by name was recognized as the writer of one of the negative letters to the Sentinel following the conference, which exclusively invited her and many other Jewish people to attend. And this woman wrote a very nasty letter to the Sentinel, almost totally disparaging the conference. And ending the letter by saying, "Shame on you, PUC," meaning Peace United Church in Christ, for, you know, daring to host such a conference. We can't even get together and talk about our stuff. Okay, let me get back to the reading now and try to stick with it. Israeli admission to the UN continued. Quote, "The preamble of the resolution of admission included a safeguarding clause as follows. Recalling his resolution of 29 November 1947 on partition of Palestine and 11 December 1948 on repatriation and compensation, and taking note of the declarations and explanations made by the representative of the government of Israel before the ad hoc political committee in respect of the implementation of the said resolutions, the General Assembly decides to admit Israel into membership in the United Nations." So, folks, this was a conditional admission of Israel, which is probably not unlike the admission of most other members of the UN in its history, taking note, etc., etc. Continuing with this clause, though, here it must be observed as a condition and an undertaking to implement the resolution mentioned. Here it must be observed is a condition and undertaking to implement the resolutions mentioned. There was no question of such implementation being conditional on the conclusion of peace on Israeli terms, as the Israelis later claimed to justify their non-compliance. There was no question of such implementation being conditional on the conclusion of peace on Israeli terms, as the Israelis later claimed to justify their noncompliance. Sammy Hadawi from Bitter Harvest. What was the fate of the Palestinians who had now become refugees? The winter of 1949, the first winter of exile for more than 750,000 Palestinians, was cold and hard. Families huddled in caves, abandoned huts, or makeshift tents. Many of the starving were only miles away from their own vegetable gardens and orchards in occupied Palestine, the new state of Israel. At the end of 1949, the United Nations finally acted. It set up the United Nations Relief and Works Administration, UNRWA, to take over 60 refugee camps from voluntary agencies. It managed to keep people alive, but only barely keep them alive. Again, from Our Roots Are Still Alive by the People's Press Palestine Book Project. And that completes the section on statehood and expulsion, 1948. Let's see, we begin page 14 now. Oh, goodness, you probably still will not finish this because there are 40 pages in this booklet here.